You are Locked On Raptors, part of the Locked On Podcast Network.
Hey, how's it going? Welcome to episode number 287 of Locked On Raptors for Friday, March 2nd. I'm your host, Sean Woodley of LockedOnRaptors.com and RaptorsHQ.com. You can find me on Twitter, of course, at WoodleySean. Show's on Twitter as well at Locked On Raptors. You can find links to every single episode. Of course, make sure you're checking out the Locked On Podcast Network as well. Lots of great stuff on there for you. Daily Locked On NBA shows with all the different hosts from across the network chipping in. You can check out the individual team-focused shows for both the NBA and NFL if you'd like. The NFL Combine is going on right now, so if you want to hear about some prospects, I guess that's the place to go. Check out the podcast for all 32 NFL teams. And if you find a host that you like at either the NBA or Locked On NFL Network, make sure you find the show on iTunes, leave a rating, leave a review, subscribe, all that good stuff. It's very helpful to those hosts. It makes those shows more popular. And you can do that with us. Find Locked On Raptors on iTunes, leave a rating, leave a review. It takes no time at all. It very much helps to make us more popular, make us more visible. It's good for the algorithm, all that good stuff. Good for my ego as well. And I appreciate you doing it ahead of time. All right, on today's show, very exciting show. I'm joined by former Raptors GM, also former GM of the Knicks as well, and also the Denver Nuggets, which people kind of forget, Glenn Grunwald. Very happy that I could take about 45 minutes of Glenn's time to talk about the sort of the early days of the Raptors, his time with the team. We talked about the Knicks as well, talked about some of the sort of disadvantages the Raptors went into their sort of expansion process with compared to past expansion teams and things like that. This was a really great chat. We went a whole bunch of different places, and it was a great time. Of course, Glenn is now the athletic director at McMaster University in Hamilton, and I was able to sit down with him in his office. And again, it was a really great time. Great to catch up with Glenn. And he was pretty candid about some stuff, so I hope you enjoy this conversation. You can also listen to yesterday's podcast as well if you're in the mood for podcasts. I spent a lot of time editing a thing I did with Katie Heindel, who is becoming a regular on the show because she's awesome. She wrote a piece for The Classical back in like 2015, a short story about Chuck Hayes. It's fan fiction, and we did a dramatic reading of it. I did the voice acting, she did the narration, and I put some audio stuff in there. It's really great. Like, honestly, it's one of the more fun times I've ever had doing a podcast. It was really cool to put together. So please check it out. A Chuck Wagon Belongs in Texas with myself and Katie Heindel from yesterday. It was a great time. And I appreciate you listening to that one. And let me know if you like it. We're probably going to do more of them because they're really fun to do. Even if no one listens, they're fun to do. So why not do them? All right. I'm going to stop talking now. We're going to get to the conversation now with Glenn Grunwald, former Raptors GM. We go about 45 minutes or so. And I'm not going to come back on the other side. So this will be it for the week. Next week, we will, I don't know, there's some games to talk about next week, I suppose. It's not the best week. I mean, the Houston Rockets on Friday, I suppose. That's an interesting one. But other than that, it should be a pretty light week for Raptors stress, I think, probably. If you're in the Toronto area on Thursday, March 8th, come out to Hoop Talks Trivia Night. I'm hosting it at The Pint, 277 Front Street West. It's going to be a lot of fun. If you have been to one of these before, you know it's a pretty good time. It's pretty easy going. I'll make fun of you pretty bad if you get questions wrong. It should be just an awesome time. We're going to watch, I think, the Celtics play the Wolves or something like that. We'll put the game on, and we'll do trivia throughout the night. It's a good time, so please come on out. You can sign up. My pinned tweet has the link where you can sign up a team. You sign up a team of three, and if you're a free agent, if you don't have a team, you can sign up as a free agent as well, and we'll put you on a team. Please come on out. It's a lot of fun, and I hope to see some faces out there, and it's always nice interacting with the podcast listeners, and I hope to see you there at The Pint, 277 Front Street West on Thursday. Doors open at 7 o'clock. All right, now let's get to the chat with Glenn Grunwald, and we will talk to you again next week with some more episodes of Locked On Raptors. Cheers. All right, joining me now on Locked On Raptors, a very special guest who I'm very thankful to have on, the former general manager of the Raptors, New York Knicks, Denver Nuggets as well. It's Glenn Grunwald, now the athletic director of McMaster University. How's it going, Glenn?
Hi, Sean. Everything's well here at McMaster, so we're excited about our playoffs as they approach.
Yeah, it's been a pretty wild week or so for Mac basketball, the women's side at least. The men unfortunately lost their first round matchup, but Wednesday against Ottawa U, that was certainly a game.
Yeah, we pulled out the come from behind win. Linnea Harper hit a couple of free throws with seconds on. So now we've got the number one ranked Carleton Ravens in for the OUA championship game tomorrow, Saturday at 1 o'clock. So we're excited to see that.
Yeah, if you're in the Hamilton, Burlington, anywhere west of Toronto area, come and check out the games. They're very fun. I do PA. Some people say that's all right. I don't know.
Yeah, you did a great job, John. Yeah, great job.
Yeah,
yeah, so it's a pleasure to talk to you. Obviously, lots of questions for you because, I mean, you kind of oversaw the first positive era of Raptors basketball, and for a long time it was the only positive era of Raptors basketball. I kind of want to go back to the early days, right? Because there was this whole stigma around the Raptors, oh, they're from Canada, like it's such a difficult place to lure players. Was the Canada thing, like the quote-unquote Canada thing, was that like a big hindrance to you in the early days of your tenure with the Raptors in terms of trying to keep guys around? Obviously, there was the Marcus Camby thing, you know, whether he was going to re-sign. There was Damon Stoudemire. Obviously, he ended up being traded as well. And Tracy McGrady leaves. Like, was the Canada thing really like a huge hindrance to you as you were trying to do your job?
Well, I think it was a bit of a hindrance. There were some issues that were real, you know, the need to go through customs on a regular basis when you're traveling with the team. Not having the availability of ESPN, I guess, can be sort of a valid one. But you know, really, I felt that the Canada issue was more of an excuse because obviously, you know, we entered the league with an old form of the expansion agreement that was a bit more punitive to the expansion teams because, mm-hmm. you know, Orlando had done so well in terms of getting the number one draft pick 2 years in a row. So they made sure that we were not going to be competitive for a while. I think players in general didn't want to go to a non-competitive situation where it would be difficult to win. And I think that was more of used as an excuse than as a real reason. But, you know, obviously it is a different country, so there, you know, people maybe a little more parochial than they need to be. But I think Toronto was always appreciated as a great city to visit. Mm-hmm. And I think most of the players that did approach it with an open mind, you know, and felt that it was a great place to come and play and live. Now, Toronto, like a lot of other teams in the NBA, is a cold weather winter city, right? Yeah. So that's an advantage that certain teams have teams have an advantage for. So there's nothing we can do about that, but that doesn't prohibit a team from being successful. The taxes were another thing that I think we were able to, with a lot of education of agents and players, that, you know, I think we can, you know, modify a contract appropriately to lessen the impact of Canadian taxes on an American resident.
Fair enough.
So we managed to sort through it, but it was it's certainly an issue. And I know the NBA is talking about expanding to Mexico City now, and
yeah,
that's another language, much different culture, and we'll see if that ever actually happens.
Yeah, I mean, it makes more sense than let's put a team in London. And but yeah, that's so the big one, I think, maybe the early example of the whole, you know, the people not wanting to come to Canada thing was the Kenny Anderson deal with Damon Stoudemire. He's sent to Portland. Kenny Anderson doesn't want to come back. And, you know, that kind of is sort of a prelude almost to the Vince Carter trade after you're not with the team anymore. When you saw the Vince Carter trade and the return and then Alonzo Mourning not coming back, did you feel like sympathy for Rob Babcock in that situation, considering just like it was kind of a similar situation in terms of like a star that wanted out as the Damon Stoudemire thing with a guy coming back, the biggest name in the deal not coming back? Or was it like, I could have done better than that?
Well, I thought the whole Vince Carter thing was mishandled. So,
yeah,
you know, they put themselves in a situation where they had to do a bad deal for what was a great player. You know, he went on to lead the Nets to two finals after that, and completely mismanaged the whole relationship. And then the trade obviously didn't work out very well. And it's a tough job to be an NBA general manager, and they felt they had to make a trade. I didn't seem like a good trade in the first place, but certainly when Alonzo Mourning wasn't going to play.
Yeah.
I don't know if they knew that going in or not, but that made it even worse.
Was there, you know, before your time with the team ended, was there ever sort of a call to potentially look into training Vince Carter? Was it something that happened after you were there? Like, how did that sort of go? Because obviously the relationship wasn't perfect the entire time, you know, with the injuries and, you know, the we can maybe talk about him going to his, you know, college graduation. But was there ever sort of an impetus from above, like, yeah, maybe we should look at trading this guy?
I think as the general manager of any team, you're obligated to consider all options at all times. And so you obviously, maybe it's not number one on your list. But, during my last season there, Vince had made some mistakes. I don't think they were really serious mistakes, a lack of maturity perhaps, or perhaps perspective in terms of his role on the team and what, his actions mean. So at the end there, I had Richard Petty milked the last bit of information out of me before he fired me, had made some proposals as terms of my annual strategic planning to that might have included Vince in a trade. It
okay.
made some sense. But then I got fired before that happened. I wasn't certainly my first choice. And I think, like the whole franchise itself, we were, new, we were learning, we were maturing, we were figuring things out. So as an expansion franchise and a new star player, Vince was growing just as the franchise was growing.
Right.
And, disappointed I wasn't allowed to finish the job, but at the same time, Masai's obviously got it going great this year, and we can see, the potential being achieved from this franchise in this great market.
Yeah. So we can kind of work backwards then, because I mentioned the Vince graduation thing, and that's obviously well before the trade ever happens. What was the reaction internally when that happened, when he went to North Carolina to graduate on the day of Game 7? Because I know it was like the easy narrative for the media to be, harping on that as like the reason they ended up losing, which obviously is kind of missing the point, I think, a little bit, because he still played reasonably well. Allen Iverson didn't play very well in that game either, right? And, if Vince makes that shot at the end, we're probably never talking about it again. So I never thought it was that big a deal as like a fan, but as the front office, like how did the team feel about him going? Was there ever a discussion about it at all?
Oh, we had, a lot of meetings about it. I think from the team in the locker room, I don't think that they viewed it as a big deal, one way or the other. As you said, Vince played pretty well, not great, but pretty well in the game. He did miss that last second shot that would have, put it to bed for rest. But, we had extensive discussions with, ownership, Larry Tannenbaum, Lenny Wilkins was the coach at the time, myself, Vince and his mother. Our opinion was that he shouldn't go, but reasonable people can disagree on that. Vince and felt that, as a role model for young men, the importance of education was significant, and to make a statement in such a high profile situation that getting your education is such an important thing to do. You have to respect that, and it's certainly a good reason to attend the graduation. But we didn't agree with it, but at the same time, we supported making it as easy as possible on him. So Larry took his plane, went with him to the graduation, and then flew him into the game. So it was, minimal impact in terms of, I think, the travel in preparation for the game. It happened, we had to win the game six, I think, on the Friday night.
I was at that game.
Yeah.
I was like a 7-year-old kid. Yeah. That was wild.
And we had, so it was sort of a moot point until we won that game. And, it was on the horizon as an issue to deal with. And so after that game, we've had some extensive discussions about it. And, it turned out as it did, and would Vince do it differently, had to do it over? I don't know, that's a good question to ask him. But again, his reason for doing it, being a role model for the community, again, reasonable people can disagree on that kind of thing.
Do you think it changed the outcome of the game at all?
Oh, it's hard to say. Butterflies wing,
yeah,
wing,
Larry Tannenbaum private jet wing, yeah.
But it is what it is now, and we live with the decisions we make and the outcomes that occur.
Is the Raptors franchise still in Toronto if Vince isn't there? Because obviously we saw it happen with Vancouver, where they couldn't really gain traction with a star outside of like Sharif Abdur-Rahim, and then after that, it's kind of on the wall for them. Without Vince, are the Raptors kind of going down the same road?
I don't think so. I mean, I think there were, when I was first a GM, we had a terrible year. You know, we were 16-66 my first year, I think it was. And and there was talk about, you know, attendance dropping and fans not interested and, you know, it was never going to work. But I don't believe that. I think it was always going to be successful. I think a couple key distinctions between, you know, the Raptors and the Vancouver Grizzlies is that, you know, this is sort of corporate Canada's headquarters in Canada. So, you know, so much of the revenue of a NBA team is dependent upon, you know, corporate support, whether it's season tickets and corporate entertainment or sponsorships and advertising, all those sorts of things. So Toronto is, you know, nothing against Vancouver, but it's a much stronger market in that regard. Mm-hmm. I think the more significant issue that had to be dealt with was the construction of a new stadium. So the expansion agreement with the NBA and the Toronto Raptors and the Vancouver Grizzlies both specified that we had to build a new arena to play basketball in. And as you know, we played in Sky Dome and Maple Leaf Gardens.
How weird was that?
It was a little different. But the fact is that, you know, the Maple Leafs were the more established and stronger franchise, and they were not cooperative with ownership at the time. And there was, you know, a desire from the Maple Leafs to build a new arena. And I think, you know, the Raptors broke ground first. You know, the issue on how to deal with the new arena situation caused the split between John Binto and Alan Slate. You know, it was a difficult decision, business decision to make. So, you know, the shotgun happened. John Binto and his family were bought out by Alan Slate. And Alan proceeded and broke ground at the Air Canada Centre. And significant move, a lot of risk associated with that. But what basically happened, then it forced the Maple Leafs' hand, and they wound up, you know, acquiring the Raptors or merging with the Raptors. And so that only one arena was built in Toronto, one new arena was built in Toronto. Because that really, I think, would have affected the financial sustainability of the Raptors had they been competing with the Leafs in terms of the ancillary events, the concerts, the shows, all those other sorts of things, the naming rights, the, you know, in-arena advertising, all those sorts of things. But by having the two teams under one roof in a great new arena like Air Canada Centre, you know, it allowed those synergies really to be maximized and the revenue to be maximized as well. So it really, I think that was the key thing that established the Raptors as being solid financially.
Fair enough. So the summer in 2000 when T-Mac leaves, what is your processes that's happening? Because obviously you see you have this like burgeoning superstar on your team. Maybe he's unhappy being behind Vince Carter, who knows. What is your pitch to T-Mac for him to stay, and like how does that offseason transpire?
Well, you know, at the time, the collective bargaining agreement, you know, we talked to the league about not doing this, but the collective bargaining provided for a rookie contract that was only 3 years with no right of first, no right to match. A player after his rookie contract became an unrestricted free agent. And, you know, T-Mac was an immature player in person at the time, I think, and didn't quite understand, you know, what the opportunities were there. He wanted to have his own team and all those kinds of things. So after his second year, you know, we did offer him a maximum contract, which, you know, was, in my opinion, a bit of a risk because, you know, he hadn't really shown his, he had shown his potential perhaps, but he hadn't shown that he was ever really going to reach that. And he turned it down. And when I knew, when he did that, I knew we were going to be in rough. So the problem then became, well, he wouldn't commit to another team either. He wouldn't say where he wanted to go and where he would resign.
Right.
So it was difficult to find another team that'd be interested in you know, giving up a lot for an immensely talented, although unproven player. When they weren't sure they could resign him. So, you know, it was going to be a tough situation. So we explored some trades during the season and you know, we made our best pitch about, you know, the possibility of playing together with Vince and the progress we were making as a franchise and what it would mean for him to stay and play and his role and his significance and all those things. But, you know, he wanted to, you know, return to warm weather. He wanted to go back home to Orlando. You know, it wasn't even, you know, he was definitely the third option for Orlando.
Right. So that was the Tim Duncan summer,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. Yeah. Tim Duncan was the first choice, and then Grant Hill, and you know, it wasn't even that they were, you know, making such a huge run for him. Obviously, they were recruiting him, but it was pretty clear that if they had signed Tim Duncan and Grant Hill, they weren't going to be able to sign him. Mm-hmm. Chicago was in the picture too, as well, another option for him. So, you know, it was just, I don't think there's anything we could have done. He wanted to move on. He wanted to get his own team, and the rules were against us, and it was unfortunate. It would have, you know, I think it did set the franchise back tremendously. The league learned from that, from our pain and suffering. Not only did they change the rules on restricted free agency after rookie contracts, but they also made new expansion agreements a little more favorable to the expansion teams.
So the Raptors were the guinea pig for all these rules.
We suffered through some learning of the NBA.
I find that three-year rookie contract thing so fascinating now. Like, to think of what that would look like in today's NBA, where it's a league of player empowerment. And like, I, as a general NBA fan, in addition to a Raptors fan, like I like it. I like players being able to kind of dictate where they want to go. And it is kind of crazy to me that if a guy is in a place he doesn't want to be, that he might be there for like 8 years. Maybe 3 years is a little too short and not enough time to really get a gauge on a guy. But like, what do you think that three-year thing would look like in today's NBA? Because I can't even imagine it at this point, considering how we're so just like stuck in the ways now of what we.
Well, I don't think teams would be tanking as much as they currently are. I think the process would probably have not been as appealing, because, you know, obviously now teams are really valuing first round draft picks and second round draft picks for that matter, just because of the right to retain them for over the course of their career and as they develop and at a reasonable price. So, yeah, no, I think it would be a different NBA, and you would probably see less tanking, you'd see less value in draft choices, and certainly more free agency. So, yeah, it's a different situation.
Was there ever a concerted effort to tank when you were with the Raptors?
I know we were always bad to start. So. I think in New York, I think I would have suggested, and again, maybe it's why I got fired, that, you know, we had a good run with Carmelo. We, you know, won 54 games, won the first round of the playoffs, probably should have beaten Indiana, had some injuries and some issues there. I think that run with Carmelo Anthony, our mission, our goal as established by the owner was to win an NBA championship as soon as possible. And so that's what we did. All our decisions were based upon that. You know, whether they were the right decisions or not, we were just trying to do the best we can with that guidance and direction. So I think, you know, when they re-signed Carmelo Anthony, you know, I'd set it up so that there'd be a tremendous amount of value in terms of the salary cap room they had. I think we could have traded Carmelo for some real value then and started over on a rebuilding process. I think it was a tremendous mistake by the Knicks to go ahead and re-sign Carmelo. And you see the sort of the shape they're in.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. I have next questions, but we'll get to that.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
All right. But no, so that would be the only time I would have suggested. The, you know, it's appropriate to do at certain times.
Yeah.
But we didn't have any issues with tanking.
Right, right.
We were just trying to become competitive and establish Toronto as a place where players realize that they could win.
Yeah, for sure. And I guess that you can't really afford to go out of your way to lose at that point, especially, say, season happens, right?
It was set up for us already. We didn't have to do anything.
What goes into the draft day trade for Vince? Going back even further before I go forward, Anton Jameson for Vince Carter. What is, like, it seems like a weird trade from Golden State's perspective. Like, what goes in, like, how does that transpire on draft day?
Well, Vince was always our guy, even though Butch Carter, he wanted the draft tractor trailer.
Okay.
But I think the rest of the staff pretty much wanted to go with Vince and saw his potential. And he was going to – we were pretty confident he was going to be there when we were drafting at five. Was that right?
Yeah.
Okay. And then Golden State was six, right?
Right. So, I think it was 4-5.
4-5? Okay. Yeah. We were drafting at four. And So it wasn't our idea. It was Golden State's idea. And there were rumors out there because Don Nelson was in the draft. He's well known for lying about whatever he's talking about, particularly in trades or drafts. So he was throwing a lot of junk up against the wall, and he had gotten Golden State concerned that we were going to draft Antoine Jameson. Golden State always wanted to get Antoine Jameson. That was their number one choice. Mm-hmm. And so they were concerned that we were going to, not necessarily that we wanted Antoine Jameson, but we were going to draft Antoine Jameson for somebody else.
Right.
And then trade flip-flop with somebody that drafted Vince Carter later. And I think, you know, Don Nelson created that impression for some reason. So they called us up and said, hey, you know, we don't want to give you a lot. We don't think you want Antoine Jameson, but, you know, we just want to guarantee that we're going to get our guy, and you can get your guy and Vince. And so that's basically what happened. So we agreed to draft Antoine Jameson first. It, you know, saved us a little bit of money.
Right.
Back then, you know, money was pretty tight for the Raptors. So we saved a few a few hundred thousand dollars in terms of the salary, and they gave us a little bit of money to do that. And it was just for Golden State, created some certainty for them that they were going to get the player they wanted.
But ultimately, you guys were going to take Vince anyway?
We were going to take Vince anyway.
It's those weird NBA trades are fun. I was doing a little digging on the pick that became Vince. How it was traded for Chris Webber two times before it was ever used. There's like three entries for it on Basketball Reference before
that right?
draft.
Yeah,
it's bizarre.
Yeah.
So yeah, the fact that it got traded once
more. To be like a draft tree, right? To see where
it was like a Penny Hardaway, Chris Webber trade that it originally was in. And it was originally the Warriors pick, and it ended up coming back to the Warriors. Then obviously they traded to you guys. Wild. Tom Gugliotta was in there somewhere. But yeah, I'm hosting a trivia tournament on the podcast, so
that would be a good one.
I'm doing some strange trivia. Digging on Basketball Reference of late.
Cool.
I read a Q&A with you yesterday from about 2014 with Raptors HQ. Friend of the program, John Chick, did it with you. You mentioned in there that when you hired Kevin O'Neill, you interviewed three other people: Sam Mitchell, Mike Woodson, and Dwayne Casey.
Yeah.
That's kind of crazy.
Yeah, I made the worst possible decision. Another reason I got fired. Probably deservedly so for that one. It's interesting that both Dwayne and Sam became head coaches with Toronto. And then I worked together with Mike Woodson in New York as our head coach.
Right.
So, yeah. And all three of those guys would have been much better.
Yeah, what happened with Kevin O'Neill? I remember as a fan, that season was not my favorite because the offense was, it seemed to be put to the back burner a little bit.
Yeah. Actually, the NBA league office called me at the beginning of the year. What is going on with you guys? Why can't you score points? I said, it wasn't a good thing.
What was the thought process
behind
the hiring?
The thought process was in part that... it was an error on my part. There are some obvious character issues that were known, and I, you know, had the hubris, I guess, to think that I could deal with them, and I couldn't.
Right.
And, I've learned that lesson. That's my advice to young people now as they go up their career in terms of, you know, making sure you hire for attitude and character and then training for skills and aptitude and stuff like that, so to make sure that that's such a key thing. So I learned that lesson. I think, you know, another thing was, it's always just sort of going too far the other direction. We were going from Lenny Wilkins, who was more of a easygoing coach, and we felt we needed something stronger, and we overreact by going too far in the other direction was part of it. And, you know, part of it was desperation too, like, you know, we need to really shake this up and do something different. So it was a bad decision, and, you know, I live with it. And
fair enough.
And those are the consequences.
Do you remember Dwayne's interview? Do you remember how that went? Like your impressions of him?
Yeah, I've known Dwayne for a long time. We had spent a lot of time together, actually in Athens, of all places, when the World Championships were there in 1998, was it?
Okay.
So, and so I got to know him, knew him at the time, a very high character, high quality person, great basketball man, dedicated and all that kind of stuff. So yeah, he was impressive. He was probably the second choice, should have been the first choice, but that's the way things go. And then Woody was new on his sort of coaching thing, so he wasn't quite, I think Woody's a great coach, he would make a great head coach, and was a great head coach for us in New York, but he wasn't quite ready yet. And
right.
I've known Woody since we were teenagers, right? So you know, that was a tough one for me not to hire him. But I think it helped him grow and helped him improve, not only as a coach, but as a person that interviews for a head coaching position.
I think
that's a skill in and of itself. You know, Kevin O'Neill is pretty good at that. And then Sam was just right out of done playing basketball as a player.
Right.
And had just been 1 or 2 years as an assistant coach. And again, very impressive. But I don't think was quite ready to be a head coach.
What do you think of the way the Raptors have gone about grooming Jerry Stackhouse? Probably for another team at this point, but it seems like a different sort of path that maybe ex-players haven't really taken, but he's done 2 years now in the D-League. They're for the G-League now, and they seem to be pretty successful. And you know, maybe like Jason Kidd, for example, a guy who went immediately into coaching, just kind of fizzled out. Now he's been let go from two teams now.
Yeah.
Like, what do you make of the sort of strategy that they've used for Jerry Stackhouse? Is that
It's great. I think, you know, obviously Jerry's done a great job with the 905 and had great success and gets that tremendous experience about, you know, just the daily grind of being a coach and showing the dedication and interest in doing it at, you know, that level where it's a little, you know, not as luxurious or you don't have the same amount of resources. And I think the Raptors have really done a great job in terms of making the most of their D-League, G-League franchise and developing not only players but coaches and staff. And and so I think it's great. It wasn't available really back when I was around, but you know, I think we'll soon have 30 G League teams for each NBA team, one for each NBA team, and it's great. And yeah, that whole experience, again, to understand what it's like to lead a team and to coach and to prepare and to deal with all the issues. You know, it's funny. When I was with the Raptors, Ken Olynyk, who's the father of Kelly Olynyk, who
right.
plays for the Miami Heat and was the head coach of the University of Toronto men's basketball team. And he took a sabbatical for a year and spent the year as a sort of a visiting coach or assistant coach with our team when Lenny Wilkins was the head coach. And at the end of it, I was, you know, quizzing him a little bit about what he learned and all that kind of stuff. And he said, you know, it's basically the same. It's about people, right? Mm-hmm. And it's about getting people to, you know, overcome challenges and come together as a team. And but it's the same. They have the same feelings. They have the same issues. They have the same family. And so, you know, I think that to me that was really enlightening. The same things that he's experiencing as a Jerry Stackhouse, that is, as a head coach in the G League, he'll have a lot of those same issues when he becomes a head coach in the NBA.
That's always been my argument for, like, when people are like, oh, fire Dwayne Casey. Like, people don't, I think, you know, they look at maybe the X's and O's and the adjustments or whatever and feel like he maybe leaves something on the table. But I don't think you can say that he's not great at managing people. And, I mean, he's turned Kyle Lowry into an all-star and things like that. So I think that's a very good point. Is there a player that was with the Raptors during your time with them that really could have used a G League to maybe that didn't end up with the team because they didn't develop along the right curve?
Absolutely. You know, you see these young players or even some players coming back from injury or making adjustments. Definitely. And you know, it's tough. You know, I think it's become more accepted by players to go to the G League, right?
Mm-hmm.
And because before there was such a, you know, perception that you're, you know, being demoted.
Yeah.
But now I think some teams, you know, like the Spurs and Houston have really shown that it can really be a benefit to a player as he develops, and assuming you resource it appropriately with the right staff and present it in the right way, you know, it is something. So yeah, I you know, we should have done it more in New York. We should have, if we had it in Toronto, we would have done it more in Toronto. I think it's a great resource and great for basketball. I think, you know, we often talk about the issues with the NCAA and the one and done rule. You know, I think, you know, that's going to grow to be a real alternative to really NBA caliber high school players, instead of going to school where, you know, you're sort of making a mockery of what the NCAA is supposed to be doing.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a real option to go to the G League and maybe another minor league or obviously foreign teams too, to develop, and then you can always come back to school, not unlike what happens in junior hockey here in Canada. So I think it's going to result in probably a better alternative and perhaps a little better situation for the NCAA ultimately, that we have this other alternative as it grows and develops.
Right. Charles Oakley, you traded for him with the Raptors. This is a very, there was no transition to make there. I just had to dive into it. You trade for him. Obviously, he's kind of around the Knicks as well. You must have a Charles Oakley story. Like, what is your best Charles Oakley story that maybe people haven't heard?
I don't know. No, it was, you know, when we first traded for him, like, you know, he didn't want to come. You know, obviously, same situation. He was, you know, established with a perennial playoff team with the New York Knicks in New York City. Was a veteran, obviously, had been in the playoffs every year of his career, and we were a team that hadn't made the playoffs yet, and young and developing, and so you know, we traded for him and got on a call with him, and he's a little grumpy. He's sometimes grumpy.
As Oak does, yeah.
But we arranged for him to come up to Toronto, fly up to Toronto, and go through his physical and all the things you need to do, and introduce him and try and get him excited about playing for us. So Butch Carter and I were waiting for him at Pearson Airport, and his flight came in, and Oak didn't show up. So so Butch and I got on the plane and went to, he was in Atlanta at the time, and found him in the hotel weight room or fitness center there in Atlanta, and started talking to him and had a good meeting with him and
threw him in the bag, and
he ultimately came up. But you know, I think we had to show him a little respect and love, and how much we appreciated him, you know, what he would mean to our team. And he was very valuable to our team, you know. So you know, it was he's his own man, Charles Oakley. I have a lot of respect for him. He did a lot for the Raptors franchise and for the players on the team and the community. You know, like anyone, he's not perfect, but you know, I think it was a key factor in us developing and becoming more than just a sort of a factory for young talent to have other teams sign.
What was your response to the Dolan thing last year with him?
Very sad. I felt bad. I don't think Oakley deserved that. Yeah. I guess there's a lawsuit pending, so we'll have to see what happens with that. Again, I think, you know, I don't think, you know, I think you just got to deal with him. Like, he might not like what he says all the time, but mm-hmm. I think if you show respect to him and talk to him about it and you know, give him an audience and listen, really listen to him and understand what he's saying, you know, I think he's great. So I don't think, you know, that happened with the Knicks, and you know, it was very sad and disappointing that he was treated in such a fashion.
Fair enough. I have one very specific Raptors question, then we can get a couple of Knicks things and I'll let you go. So there's this player who's become kind of a cult hero among the podcast and among podcast listeners, mostly because of me, because I talk about him all the time. LaMarc Baker. Do you remember LaMarc Baker? He's a guy who played two NBA minutes in the 1999-2000 season, or might have been 98-99. 2 minutes. He was
for the Raptors?
Yeah, for the Raptors. He was 0 for 1 in his career. His first NBA game, his only NBA game, came when he was 29 years old. He was like an Ohio State star, played in a bunch of random leagues.
I need to know. Point guard?
I think he was a point guard. I think he goes by Mark Baker now. I think he's
Mark Baker, yeah.
Yeah, I think he's like a high school athletic director now.
What? Okay, yeah.
The guy perplexes me because he's, I think he holds, he's one of three Raptors players ever to play for the team and never score. And his only NBA game took place for the Raptors. He played 2 minutes and never played in the NBA again. I need to know the story of acquiring Mark Baker, LaMarc Baker.
Well, I tell you what, I'm drawing a bit of a blank. I vaguely remember, you know, it's funny that you see so many players come through and, and I don't have the best memory. My wife will tell you that. but I think he was a player that came in as sort of a free agent tryout and was invited to training camp. And we had some injuries at the point guard position, and we needed somebody. And he was a pretty good player. And so he made the team for a while until I think he got cut because we had a you know, another opportunity available. Right. But, you know, there's, I mean, that's the thing that I don't think people realize, particularly young players, the number of players out there that are quality basketball players is so high. You know, he was close to being an NBA player, Mark Baker, and a good person, and we see so many of those people, and it's so tough to make the NBA. You got to be, you know, be in the right place at the right time when the opportunity is there for you. For most players, obviously, some extremely talented people are going to find their way to the league anyways, but there's so many people that are on the fringe. You know, we used to have free agent camps in the summer just to see what was out there, and really, you know, like the quality of the player is so good, but you know, the opportunities are so slim. There's only, you know, you may have guaranteed contracts and only have three or four or two openings on your roster, so you know, it's not that you can't have a good life and make a good living playing elsewhere in other leagues, but to make the NBA as not a top level talent, it's you know, it takes some good fortune and a lot of perseverance and heart to keep at it and put yourself in a position to make it.
You know? I had to ask just because
Lamarck Baker. I knew Mark Baker. Yeah, okay. That threw me off there.
Yeah, it's a very incredible NBA career that I've tried to reach out to him. I've tried to reach out to Ohio State. Hasn't worked. If you ever come cross paths with Mark Baker again, let me know. Give him my email or something. Let's fast forward to the Knicks time. Obviously, you mentioned the nice run you guys had with Melo there. What was it, 2011-12? That's the right year, right? 2012-15,
yeah,
something like that. Yeah.
You
know, 50 games, you guys kind of, you know, you kind of expand on maybe the, you know, sort of the seeds that the 7 seconds or less Suns planted in the mid-2000s. You guys shot a ton of threes. J.R. Smith and all these guys. Like, it was a really fun team to watch. The summer after that, I have to ask you about the Landry Field Steve Nash thing, because this was, I'm not sure if it's ever been actually reported, but the saying goes is that the Raptors signed Landry Fields to an offer sheet in order to tie up the Knicks cap space so Steve Nash wouldn't sign with the Knicks and maybe sign with the Raptors. What is your, like, what's your, from your perspective, how does that all play out? Were you like, why are they offering Landry Fields this much money? Like, what was that summer like for you as, like, sort of the receiver of what the Raptors were apparently trying to do to try to get Steve Nash?
Yeah. So we were both, us and the Raptors were chasing Steve. And that was my understanding, although I really should talk to Brian Colangelo about, you know, why they made that offer to Landry, who was a good player, you know, but he got hurt with the Raptors. I think that's the thing that's unfortunate for Landry, you know, he wasn't able to really play. But he's a pretty good NBA player, and in the right role would be effective. And so that was my understanding, that they were trying to force us to re-sign Landry, force the Knicks to re-sign Landry, and did that for that reason. So.
Fair enough. Yeah.
So, but again, I wasn't in the Raptors' machinations in terms of why.
Yeah, it's just I don't even know if it's actually been fully reported out. It's just kind of the rumblings go around, and it's one of the more interesting sort of off-season machinations for Raptors.
No, obviously we had Mike D'Antoni at the time, who had coached him with the Phoenix Suns, and was a big fan, and there was some appeal to that in terms of, you know, adding him to the mix, because at the time too we had Jeremy Lin, right? So, you know, it was going to be sort of a mentoring relationship and help them, you know, grow together and do it that way. It turned out we got wound up with Jason Kidd, who had a great year. I mean, but we didn't get Jeremy Lin either back. So, you know, it's funny how the roads turn and twist. And you know, I was just at a leadership seminar where, you know, everyone will say they had the great strategic plan, but really it's building the bridge as you walk on it, right? Mm-hmm. So you have to sort of know where you're trying to go, what you're trying to get to, and then you got to figure out the way you get there and be open and flexible in terms of opportunities or detours or, you know, roadblocks that come in your way.
Fair enough. One more Knicks thing. The Andrea Bargnani trade in 2013.
Yeah.
Is that something you look back on and regret? Is it, you know, was it something that was coming down from up top where they were like, all right, get this guy? Like, how did that all play out?
Yeah, I would say that that was not a good trade, obviously. I wasn't necessarily in favor of it, but, you know, let's say we were influenced by his agency and ownership to do that trade.
Right.
So, that's the nature of it sometimes.
Hey, Jakob Poeltl's doing great for the Raptors now. It's fun. Yeah.
Was that part of that deal?
Yeah he ended up being the first round pick.
He's a good player. Yeah, that's a good trade. So, but, you know, it was a mistake.
Fair enough. It has to be, obviously, I mean, you were in the early days of the Raptors before maybe they entirely caught on. I guess 2000, 2001, maybe the electricity really starts to build. But at MSG, that has to be entirely different, right? And covering the Knicks, or being, you know, being the GM of the Knicks, it has to come with just so many more different things and just factors that are coming at you, as opposed to being the GM of this like tiny outpost up north. How did it differ? Was it like a more enjoyable experience? Was it more stressful? Like what? Because I know I read the Q&A that you did, just to reference back to that. You said you were kind of, you know, you didn't really have a relationship with the media at all when you were in New York, just because of the way that their policies were. But that matter? Yeah. Was it still like a lot to deal with?
No, it was fine. Like, I had a good staff. We had a pretty good team. I had a great relationship with the coaches. We had a media policy that I followed, you know, like the only time I was to talk to the media was when it was approved by the media gurus there, and only when we had something to really announce, like a trade or a signing or whatever it might be, and maybe once or twice sort of a summary of what's going on. So I abided by that policy, which, you know, whether it's the right thing to do or not, probably not, but it made my life as a general manager a lot easier, in terms of not having to worry about that. And I think the media understood that that was a directive from above. So it was, it was fine with me. I mean, it was the way it was there.
Right. So now you're McMaster, and like, obviously this is not like a low stakes job. McMaster is one of the best athletic schools in Canada. The volleyball team is extremely good, hosting the championships coming up soon. The women's basketball team's in the Gratelli Cup final. So there's obviously stresses that come with your job, but how much of like a step back and sort of a more easygoing experience is it then being an NBA GM? Do you miss the NBA grind at all?
Yes and no. I mean, I think the NBA is fun. It's exciting. It's, you're really trying to be the best and you're focused on one thing. I think the biggest challenge that I faced here at the university is that we are what is called, I think, officially a quasi-ancillary program. So, I'm part of a much bigger organization and we're not the main focus of what we're trying to do. Education, obviously, and research here at McMaster are our main goals, but obviously, you know, the development of young people and the great experiences we provide and the community building that our department provides for the students and for the surrounding Hamilton, Burlington area is sort of what we do. But at the same time, it's different than an NBA team where, you know, you are focused on this team and you're trying to make it as good as you can, and all the resources are being devoted to that. Well, it's not the same focus here. Like we are, as they say, a quasi-ancillary operation, and we try and provide the best student-athlete experience we can. We're not only concerned about winning, you know, as an NBA team, you're not only concerned about winning either, but the balance is much more on overall development and making sure that that we help these young people grow and have a great experience, but also become, you know, our future leaders and great contributors to society, and giving back to the community too as well. That's part of the NBA too, but the balance is a little bit different, let's say. So, you know, if we don't win a national championship or have a winning team, you know, people are not really going to be fired. At a certain point in the NBA, if you're not winning and you're not doing well on the court, you're going to be fired.
Right.
And I think, you know, those are sort of significant things. Now, if you do, you know, for a long time here, if you're not doing well, you're not providing a great experience. Like, it's hard to say you're providing a great experience to a student athlete if you're not at least competitive.
Right.
So we have to be at least competitive, and we say we're trying to be excellent, but it's excellent within the resources that we have. And I think we do a great job of that here. We have great coaches. We have young people that do great things. Sometimes they make mistakes, and we help them straighten out those mistakes or learn from those mistakes. So it's a great experience here, but it's a different job in terms of, again, the balance of winning and overall development and contributing to the community.
At the very least, you must sleep better.
I slept pretty well.
Yeah.
You know, maybe trade deadline, you get a little stressed about some things when you have to make decisions. But if you do the work and you you know, trust the people, your scouts and the people around you in the NBA, and you have support of the ownership, you know, and you have a clear plan of where you're trying to go and a good, pretty good idea of how you're going to get there, I think it's you know, it's in a way, it's a lot simpler job than the job here.
Fair enough. Well, Glenn, I've taken entirely too much of your time, and I really appreciate you chatting with me. Is there anything that I missed on that I blanked, or is there?
No, yeah. I think all Raptor fans should be excited about this year. I don't know what your sense is from your listeners, but boy, it's a great job that Masai and Dwayne Casey and the whole team has done, and I'm looking forward to the playoffs, and hopefully we'll see the Raptors in the finals.
Yeah, they're good and fun at the very least, and there's something to be said for that. And thank you so much, Glenn. Hopefully we can do this again down the road sometime, and have a good one.